Well, welcome into another episode of My Strange Bible. This time we are diving into the second part of the story of Abimelech, one of the strangest and weirdest stories in the entire Bible. Alex, it's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, my friend Steve. I'm excited. This is a dark story. And it's an interesting story. I don't know why I'm smiling. It's kind of a bad story.
It is.
But it's piqued my interest. I'm excited to hear more about it. Again, you're kind of, this is something that you got excited about and kind of preached on at your church a little bit ago. So I am happy to be your second audience here and listen on.
Well, it's a bad story, but it's one that we can learn a lot from. And as I mentioned the first time, and we're going to review a little bit to make sure we're on the same page. But as I mentioned the first time, you know, this was probably a 2.5 hour long sermon that I tried to condense into 30 minutes. And I did the very best I could. And I think I gave our people something practical to take away. But I really wanted to dig into the nerdy details with you. And I knew you would be all for that.
100%. So. Yeah, I can't imagine. I need to watch the recording of the 30-minute version of this because I don't understand how it's like fitting Lord of the Rings movies into a 2-hour movie, which was actually proposed at first for Peter Jackson to do, and he said no way.
Right? Yeah. Well, hey, look. What I did was I joked at the very beginning. I said, "Listen, I've got 60 verses, 8 pages of notes, and 100 yeah. dramatic pauses." To get through in 30 minutes to do it. So, it didn't work. I'll just put it like that. So I ended up summarizing a lot of the story and really skipping over what I thought were some really important things. So I'm super thrilled to dive into this. So let's review a little bit, shall we?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, so here's where we're at in the story. So we coming off the heels of Judges 8. So in Judges 8, the end of Judges 8, verses 30 to 35, we find that Gideon is, transitioning out. I think, I guess I'd have to go back, but yeah, this is like when he died. Yeah, so verse 33 talks about when Gideon died. The Israelites turned and prostituted themselves by worshiping the Baals, and they made Baal Berit their god. And so this story picks up with Abimelech, the son of Gideon's concubine, okay? And so Gideon had 70 sons and, as you can imagine, many wives. And then he had a concubine, and he had another son, Abimelech, and we talked about how last time he might have had like 63 sons or 75 sons. The number 70 was probably chosen to royalize the number and round it out, and also was probably chosen to make a connection with Baal. In Canaanite mythology, Baal and Ashtaroth, they both had, they had babies, and so they had 70 offspring as well. So the number 70 was likely chosen for a number of reasons, but to help make that connection. And one of the things that we saw is that Judges 9 is arguably exactly what the Bible would look like if it were a Canaanite text. So Judges 9 is like Israel becomes fully Canaanite. And everything in the story is reflective of that, even the names that are used. Gideon is referred to not as Gideon, but Yerubbaal, which would be essentially his Canaanite name. It means let him contend with Baal or Baal. And so everything about this chapter is Canaanite-ish. We see God mentioned, the God of the Hebrews, but he's not called by his proper name, Yahweh. He's called by the more generic term for God in Semitic languages, which is El. But El also does happen to be the proper name of the Canaanite high creator God. So we see all this flavoring, this literary flavoring in the passage that it's a Canaanite text. And so where we're at in the story right now is this. So Abimelech, Gideon's son, and Abimelech means my father is king. So Gideon didn't want to be king. But he apparently did want to be king because he literally named his kid, my father is king. So Abimelech, my father is king, goes to his mother's family and says, look, you got to make me king, because if you don't, then the other 70 sons of Yerubbaal are going to rule over you. And that's
you're
not
just looking
be good.
To keep the peace.
Oh, yeah. Just trying to keep the peace. Totally. He was in it for them. For sure, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a, yes.
Yeah, 100%. So they're like, well, you know, he is our brother, and so he it kind of makes sense. And so here, let me give you some money. I think it was 70 shekels. Or was it 70 shekels? It was something like that. Let's see. Yep, 70 pieces of silver, yep, from the temple of Baal Berit. And so those 70 shekels equaled about $617 that he had to work with to go out and actually hire this ragtag group of 70 dudes. So it's like less than a dollar a person to actually go. And what he ended up doing was killing all of his other siblings, okay? And so he gave the people gave him money. His mother's family gave him money from the temple of Baal Berit. And he went and actually killed the rest of his family. And actually, he killed them at the Oak of the Pillar, which is the place, or actually, they crowned him king there at the Oak of the Pillar. And that's the same place where Joshua, back in Joshua 24, was talking about how Israel was going to be faithful to Yahweh for the rest of their days and serve him alone and things like that. So we saw sort of this selfish ambition that he had. And as a result of this, again, he is now in power. He's happy. He's got money. He's got the people of Shechem on his side. He's got the his brothers have been killed. And so he doesn't have to worry about them anymore. And except for one brother happens to escape. And that is where we left off last time. So that was a lot of review. Any questions or just thoughts that you had as I was going through that, Alex, so that you might be able to, you know, identify with the audience on?
No, I think that was a good summary. One question that I did have that will be helpful, I think, just to kind of refresh my mind on, and maybe people listening who never really thought about it before, but just thinking about how unfavorably this story looks at a time in Israel's history, just kind of this deep kind of dark days, you can say, that they're in. Wasn't it kind of common, though, for civilizations during this time to not write badly about themselves?
Oh, that's a good
question.
Is that only certain
cultures? Like, I had thought that, like, in Egypt or elsewhere, it was very common for them not to necessarily say, like, all the bad stuff that happened, like, to them.
Yes.
I could be wrong on that, and I don't know to what extent, but that just kind of crossed my mind that it's interesting that this kind of dark piece, and there's a lot of kind of bad things that we see throughout the Old Testament happening in Israel, but that this one in particular just kind of stands out to me in that way.
Actually, I'm really glad that you brought that point up, because this is one of the key differentiators between how the Bible records history and how many other ancient documents, especially, you know, religious documents, religious texts, record history. All right, so this has the makings of a very long nerd spasm, and I'm going to do my very best to keep it fairly short. A book that talks a lot about this is fantastic, and it's called The Bible Among the Myths by John Oswalt. He's an Old Testament professor, and I think he's retired now. But anyway, fantastic read. I've read it like twice and probably need to read it again now. But what he talks about is that there was a fundamental difference between Israel and all of her ancient Near Eastern neighbors. So even though there were a lot of similarities that they did share, the differences vastly outweighed those similarities. And one of those, the big worldview difference is that Israel had a worldview of transcendence, and all of her neighbors had a worldview of what he calls continuity. So by continuity, he means something like pantheism, right? This is why Baal is the Canaanite storm god. Okay, that's what he is. So he's the warrior god of the storm. Okay, and so for the ancients who you know, around Israel, a lot of their conceptions of God were manifestations of nature, right? So there was like, so Baal is the god of storms, right? The Asherahs, they were more of reproduction and sex and things along those lines. Okay. And there were all sorts of other iterations like this too around the ancient Near East. And so the thing about an ancient Near Eastern worldview of the other gods is that their gods were sort of seen in manifestations of nature. And this is sort of how they thought about them as having control over various domains, right? So when you think like this, Israel wasn't like that. The only time that Israel used those motifs was in a polemic sense against the other gods, okay? So in I forget exactly where it's located, but the story of Elijah? I think it's Elijah.
It's Elijah.
It is, because this is when he goes, he has this big victory, and then he goes under a tree and is feeling sorry for himself for some reason. And it's not long after that, I think, that Elisha comes on the scene. But Elijah and the prophets of Baal, right? The showdown with the prophets of Baal. There's 400 prophets of Baal, one Elijah. And the prophets of Baal were like, ha, you know, we can get our God to light this altar, no problem. So Yahweh's like, hold my beer. And he's like, here's what I want you to do, Elijah. Like, I want you to soak your altar in water. And you call down fire from heaven. And you watch, I'm going to light your altar. And the prophets of Baal, they ain't going to get nothing. And that's exactly what happened, right? So literally, like, in the story, it's one of the craziest stories with the Elijah, you know, with the prophets of Baal. They're, like, cutting themselves and tearing their clothes and everything. They're so mad because their God was defeated because the wet altar of Elijah, Yahweh lit the fire in his altar. And so what's being demonstrated, especially in the way that the text is wrote or written, is that Yahweh is the one with control over the storms, not Baal, right? Mm-hmm. Yahweh is considered in the book of Daniel, the rider on the clouds. And this is picked up with the Son of Man language in the New Testament, right? You'll see him coming on the clouds of glory, right? Yahweh. And then later, Jesus is considered the one to be the rider of the clouds. That was the same language that in the Canaanite texts they would use for Baal. And so, but obviously, there's, you know, I am that I am, right? Yahweh is transcendent. The biblical writers believe that Yahweh was entirely other than his creation, not a manifestation of nature. So very, very clearly so, right? That's the whole point of I am that I am. It basically means I'm the self-existent one. I am other than creation. And Genesis 1 is about nothing, if not the fact that God is other than creation. Everything that exists is a result of God's creating, okay? It's not like other ancient myths where literally the gods were battling and like literally part of the God was used to form the fabric of the world. You see how even that, there's like this tie-in of like how nature and creation, it's like there's no actual explanation for how everything came to exist at all. Only the Bible offers that truly. And and so it was very important, a part of that, because you asked about history and then I went off on what you thought was a rabbit trail, but I'm bringing it all back right now.
I knew you would see.
I know. Here's the thing. For the biblical writers, because God was other than creation, but acted within creation, accurate history was important. This is why Yahweh always tells Israel to remember. This is why they set up 12 stones, right? This is why the circumcision is a thing. This is why all throughout, that's just one reason why. There's multiple reasons why circumcision, boy, there's an episode for us later.
Yes.
But point being that, remembrance. I mean, heck, like Passover, right? Yom Kippur, like all these things, it's remembrance. It's what happened in the past. Everything good and bad that happened in the past matters to an Israelite. But if you look at ancient texts other than Israel, they only conveniently leave in the good details. And this is especially true of militaristic writing. But here's the thing, because of their continuity worldview, everything was cyclical. They didn't care about history because for them, history didn't really matter. Everything was cyclical in nature. Whereas for Israel, God was actually acting in nature to accomplish his will using people and spiritual beings. And because of that, everything that happened, good and bad, mattered. And this is, there's an apologetics case to be made from this of the truth of, you know, the biblical worldview. Because of that, because why record the embarrassing things too? I mean, Judges is the most embarrassing book, arguably, of the Old Testament. It's literally awful, the entire book, let alone this chapter. But the fact that it's in there gives more credence to the fact that it's true.
Yep, 100%.
So, did that satisfy? Was that the answer you were looking for? Roughly,
it was the Steve answer I was looking for.
Oh, wonderful! Yay. Okay. All right. So let's dive into the text. I'm going to let you talk now. Would you read for us, Alex, from verse 7 of Judges 9 all the way through verse 21?
7 through 21. Good. I don't see as many names as there are last time, so maybe I won't botch this.
Not as many.
As much as before. Okay, here we go. When they told Jotham, he climbed to the top of Mount Gerizim. And remember, Jotham is the one son that survived. Raised his voice and called to them, "Listen to me, citizens of Shechem, and may God listen to you. The trees decided to anoint a king over themselves. They said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Should I stop giving my oil that people use to honor both God and men and rule over the trees?' Then the trees said to the fig tree, 'Come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Should I stop giving my sweetness and my good fruit and rule over trees?' Later, the tree said to the grapevine, 'Come and reign over us.' But the grapevine said to them, 'Should I stop giving my wine that cheers both God and man and rule over trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, 'Come and reign over us.' The bramble said to the trees, 'If you really are anointing me as king over you, come and find refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Now, if you have acted faithfully and honestly in making Abimelech king, if you have done well by Jerubbaal and his family, and if you have rewarded him appropriately for what he did, for my father fought for you, risked his life, and rescued you from Midian, and now you have attacked my father's family today, killed his 70 sons on top of a large stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his slave woman, king over the citizens of Shechem because he is your brother. So if you have acted faithfully and honestly with Jerubbaal in his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and may he also rejoice in you. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech and consume the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo. And may fire come from the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo and consume Abimelech.' Then Jotham fled, escaping to Beer, and lived there because of his brother Abimelech."
All right, so clearly, after such an eloquent speech, Jotham needed a beer. So that's...
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. That's a great place to go to if you escape to Beer.
that's where he went. That's where he went, so it makes sense. Okay, so there's a lot going on here. Okay, so let's talk about Jotham. So interesting that Jotham in this story, and there's probably some sort of a, I don't know, like if I were more well-versed in literature, there's probably some sort of like, I don't know, role that he's playing here that you could point to and be like, hey, Jotham was that guy in the story. What's interesting is that he always manages to slip away, right? So Abimelech comes to kill the 70 brothers. Jotham providentially slips away and then goes to the people of Shechem and gives this speech. And then at the end of the speech, as we see here, once again, it's kind of like he gets up there, like basically scolds the people of Shechem from Mount Gerizim, and then he fled, right? He gets away again. He slithers away, right? And goes to get a beer. Goes to get a beer. And then he lived there in Be'er, we'll call it by probably what we should call it, because of his brother Abimelech, right? So he doesn't want to get killed because now not only did he get away the first time, now he's also made people hate him. word's going to get back about what he said to the people of Shechem. So, interesting that he does all this from the top of Mount Gerizim. And so in the outline, if you're following along, before I talked about this, we were on the sin of selfish ambition. That was the last point. And so this point is the solemn pronouncement, okay? Judges 9 and verses 7 through 21. This is the solemn pronouncement. So this pronouncement is coming from Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim is one of two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, that together form sort of like a natural amphitheater, okay? And so, like, if you actually get on top of the one and, like, call out, you know, you can hear very loudly. There's, like, an echo that happens, okay? And this, I mean, this is still there today, and you can see it and everything. This is the same couple of mountains where in Deuteronomy, the blessings and cursings are pronounced from either side. And Mount Gerizim was the mount of cursing or blessing, excuse me. And Mount Ebal was the mount of cursing. And so in Joshua, they sort of reenact this after after many of their military victories. They sort of reenact this whole thing of reading the blessings and cursings and all of that from Deuteronomy. What's interesting is that, again, Mount Gerizim was the mount of blessing, but this is a curse that Jotham is pronouncing, but he's doing it from the mount of blessing, which I thought was kind of interesting, right? But again, this is another area, kind of like the oak that we mentioned, that there's earlier significance, and this is the writer trying to draw our minds back. Like the you should know, as the reader of this, as the original intended reader of this, you would know the irony that this pronouncement is being hailed from the Mount of Blessing, and you would know how significant the Mount of Blessing is in your history. And here's this pronouncement from Jotham in this Canaanite text. Like, it's there's this amazing irony happening where, yeah, this is now a Canaanite text, and this pronouncement is being laid out from the Mount of Blessing that, like, should have been mapped to Israel's obedience instead of now being mapped to Israel's disobedience. So
this isn't said explicitly here, so I imagine it ventures to the realm of opinion, but what's your opinion on, do you think that, because who knows the situation just physically where, where people were set up, you know, who would hurt Jotham or turn him into his brother, but do you think that Jotham specifically chose Gerizim as a way to make the statement even more pronounced because of that? Or do you think that it's just kind of coincidental that he went up there on that mountain and not really thinking about it? Again, this is strictly, obviously, just a matter of kind of opinion.
Yeah, because there's actually a third alternative too, right? The third alternative, which I don't necessarily buy, but the third alternative is that it didn't happen exactly this way, but the story is told this way for dramatic effect, right? That would be the sort of third option. My view, so there's a lot of people who think that way. Not necessarily with this specific thing. I don't want to put words in people's mouth. But there's a lot of places where people will say, oh, well, the story was written like that, but that doesn't mean it happened that way. It was written like this for effect. My view in general is usually that if something is written a certain way for effect, it had to have happened pretty close to that, you know, pretty darn close to that, for if not exactly that way, for it to make sense. Mm-hmm. So this is where, I remember last time we talked about the royalization of you know, Baal and Gideon's sons. It's like, I don't think that he had five sons, but it says 70 because we're supposed to think Gaal.
Yeah.
Or Baal, excuse me. I'm getting my Gauls mixed up here. So, right? I think like 63, 65, 72, 77 is probably about right somewhere in there. And so I'm not mad if a number is rounded for theological purposes, but it maps pretty close to reality, right? It's like a lot of people want to say that the genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11 are wildly overinflated. And they say, well, look at ancient Sumerian king lists, right? That's like the closest thing that we have to, you know, to compare to them. And they were wildly overinflated. But guess what? The ancient Sumerian king lists, the numbers are like 33,000 years old, right? So-and-so lived to 33,000, right? Whereas the, you know, 969 was the oldest human, right, to ever live. That was Methuselah. And so, like, it's like, and there's lots of intertext reasons to think, like lots. It's a different subject for a different day we should probably tackle. There's lots of intertextual reasons to think that those numbers are pretty darn close. So, like, I'm okay if some of those numbers were rounded for theological messaging. It's probably that the actual number, though, was pretty close. I don't think it makes sense to say that Methuselah lived to 969 if he actually only lived to 96. That, right? You see how that just so doesn't make sense? So yeah, to answer your question, was he on Mount Gerizim? I think probably. Was he there intentionally? I don't know. What I do know is that the nature of this parable, this essentially fable, the story that he tells, is such that, boy, there is a lot of irony in the location, yeah. Right? And so the fact that that it happened this way is a interesting, you know, literary device. And so I think it maps to reality in some sense, but I also think that it happened this way. It happened in a way that was close enough to this reality to be able to make the literary stuff match up. Because again, I do think it's important. Like the actual thing that he says is like amazing. Like we're going to dig into it in a sec, but it's like, yeah, it's like this really, really awesome, historical fable that, and it's like, it's this curse. And I think where it's coming from matters. So yeah, did he get up there on purpose? If he did, it was probably more of a practical purpose, right? Probably more of the fact of the natural amphitheater to make it loud enough for all the people to hear him. It was probably more practical. But then but the irony of it literally in the reading and the writing would not have been lost on the original hearers. Like, oh, well, he 100%. Went up there, but yeah, like check that out, right? Look at where he did that from. So
gotcha.
Even imagine if they had come from Ebal. Right, from the other mountain. Would it have had literary impact still? Yeah, because it was, because we would want to say, it was from the Mount of Cursing. So, like, obviously, like, rah, this is Israel getting their punishment. He's pronouncing this from the Mount of Cursing. But, like, how much more ironic is it actually that it happened from the Mount of Blessing? Because this is where a completely different kind of thing should be said than what's actually said. That makes sense?
Yep, 100%.
Okay.
Yep, for sure.
All right, so I like this quote from Daniel Block, kind of on the more practical end, comparing Abimelech and his brother Jotham. So he says this, quote, "Unlike Abimelech, who is driven entirely by self-interest, Jotham seems to have the best interests of the Shechemites at heart, holding out the possibility that they may receive a hearing with God. The opening clause, however, suggests that a favorable response from God is contingent upon their listening to him instead of to the seductive promises of Abimelech," end quote. I thought that was just a nice quote that sort of summarizes where we're at in this situation. It's like God is, absolutely. God is willing to step in and to kind of do his part. But at this point in history, especially, God's like, throw me a bone, guys. Like I rescued you from Egypt. I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am the one who helped you cross the Jordan River. I'm the one who allowed you to take out all these Canaanite tribes and to take this land of possession. So it's like, choose me or choose Abimelech, this faux king that you say that you want, this bramble king who's nothing but a thorn bush. And so it's like, there's obviously so much you could say there, but like it's always the promise to follow the Bramble King is always so seductive in the moment, but it always misses the big picture of what God is able to do for you and what Jesus is able to do for you. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that pronouncement here, I think is really interesting. So the practical point that I said to that is just, Abimelech is, again, this sort of pseudo first king of Israel. I mean, like, you know, he's not even as good as Saul in that sense, right? At least Saul was appointed by God. This guy, the people just said, yeah, we want this guy. And the point is, don't get ahead of God's timing, because when you get ahead of God's timing, usually there's some idolatry in the mix, right? Usually you're worshiping something, the result, the money, the new job, you know, the new potential mate, you know, or whatever, who looks, you know, grass is always greener on the other side. Don't get ahead of God's timing, because usually there's idolatry at play whenever you find yourself doing that. You find yourself finding that there's something more meaningful than God.
I feel like next to the idolatry, there's probably a lot of indifference here as well, which is kind of, which can be looked at as the ugly cousin of all this, where you have Jotham climbing up here, and again, I don't know the situation of who directly is around him, how many people, but he just kind of, you know, slips away after this. I have a feeling if every single person was an active supporter of his brother and like actively wanting to see like bloodshed and violence and all that, they would have probably like gone up and thrown him down, not let him finish his speech or who knows what. But I have a feeling that there's a lot of indifference here where people are just thinking, well, oh, well, we have Abimelech now and just do not care. Yeah. And that's a sad state to be in as well in life.
Yeah, it totally is. And it reminds me of, so if we look at verse 16 and following, it's so funny what he's doing. So he knows exactly what he's doing, right? And we're gonna go back and talk about the actual fable a little bit, but this is kind of where he like explains his logic behind sharing this fable. He's like, if you've acted faithfully and honestly, all right, citizens of Shechem, mm-hmm. if you've acted faithfully and honestly in making Abimelech king, and if you have done well by my father, Jerubbaal, Gideon, and his family, and you've rewarded him appropriately for what he did, you know, fighting for you, risking his life, rescuing you from Midian. If you've done all that, and now you've attacked my father's family today, killed his 70 sons on top of a large stone, made Abimelech the son of his slave woman king over the citizens because of your brother. So, yeah, if you've acted faithfully and honestly with him this and his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and may he rejoice in you. But if not, right, may fire come from Abimelech. See, there's almost the blessings and cursings right there in miniature, mm-hmm. which is kind of cool, right? I love the Bible. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech and consume the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, and may fire come from the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo, consume Abimelech. Then he fled. Well, here's what's interesting, right? So just a few verses earlier, at the end of verse 8, right? They did not show, or the end of chapter 8, verse 35, they did not show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal. So the text very explicitly states that they did not show kindness and that they did not remember the Lord in all of that. Yep. And then down here, he's like, well, yeah, if you feel like you did all that, if you showed them kindness, you remembered the Lord and everything, then God bless you. That's basically what he's saying, right? God bless you. Forget I said anything, right? But he knows the truth, which is why he said what he said. So I've already mentioned that the fable itself is it's actually very widely regarded as one of the greatest, certainly, fables/parables in all of ancient literature. And there's actually some who think that this could be the first. This could actually be the first like recorded parable, fable in all of ancient literature, which is really cool. Like Aesop ain't got nothing on the Bible, you know what I'm saying? So it's really cool. There's a tremendous use of irony in the fable. And we explained some of that just in the logic. But what's interesting here is this. So, we've got this. The trees decided to anoint a king over themselves, right? He's creating a word picture here. They said, the olive tree, reign over us. And the olive tree's like, well, wait a minute. Like, I'm already pretty good at giving my oil. So should I stop giving out my oil that honors both God and man? Just to be a ruler over the other trees, right? And of course, the rhetorical answer is, well, no, that doesn't make much sense. So then, of course, the fig tree come and reign over us, but it's like, wait, should I stop giving my sweetness and my good fruit and rule over the trees? No. So the grapevine come and reign over us, but the grapevine said, well, I mean, should I stop giving my wine? It cheers both God and man and rule over the trees. And here's the irony. Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, hey, why don't you come and reign over us? And the bramble, which we know what a bramble is, it's basically a thorn bush, right? It's not a tree at all, right? So they're pointing to the bramble. Said, if you really are anointing me as king over you, right, come and find refuge in my shade. What? A thorn bush doesn't have any shade. It's, again, it's not a tree. It has no shade. Come and find refuge in my shade.
I love how it says, if you really are anointing me, I'll be king over you.
Well, yeah, if you insist, right? If you insist, come find refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon, right? So, again, there's this idea here that what Jotham is very clearly at this point actually saying to the people of Shechem is, you've crowned a thorn bush. I mean, you've basically crowned yeah. somebody who had nothing else at all to offer. And so, he asserted his authority. Now, there's obviously some differences, right? Abimelech was the initiator here, whereas the trees were the initiator in the fable. Again, the point wasn't that the details are supposed to map one-to-one. The point is that the people anointed a bramble bush, and a bramble bush is good for nothing but fire. And so that's why yep. That's why there's more irony in the story in fire, and we're going to see that as we continue on the series. But the point is that they crowned a worthless guy. They and scholars call him the Bramble King for this reason, which is why the series is titled The Rise and Fall of the Bramble King, and why I wanted to compare it with in the last episode, which if you haven't checked out, go watch or listen to that. We do a comparison between the Bramble King and the Paradise King, right? Jesus is the Paradise King, the King of gardens, the King of mountains, the King of the luscious place. Whereas Abimelech, right, representative of honestly the powers of the world, Satan and Canaanite gods and all of that, you know, Egypt, Babylon, these are all weird pictures in the Bible, the serpent, the snake, for basically representative of the same thing. You know, this is the Bramble King. This is the King of the Thorn Bush. This is the King of the Fire. All it's good for is destruction. So that's why he sort of became known as that, you know, as that figure. So let me just give you the summary statement, then we can, you know, I'll get your feedback and then we can move on. So here's the point. The trees in the parable all stay in their lane, right? They shouldn't leave their best area of contribution to rule over the others, a job they didn't ask for, weren't called to, and couldn't excel at. Like I said, the Bramble says yes to the job because he's got literally nothing else to contribute. And so there's a lesson, right? There's, again, the practical end of it is, well, what are you doing, right? Are you setting up your own kingdom? Are you, right, a bramble? Are you a thorn bush? Or are you finding a job as a tree in God's kingdom and letting that, you know, blooming, to keep the garden analogy going, blooming where you're planted? I know a lot of people who've started ministries. They even maybe start doing things in their local church. You know, what they do is they start with good intentions of working for the Lord. And then what happens is very quickly pride starts to take over. And what happens is they become a bramble bush trying to build their own kingdom. And suddenly the good that they were doing is completely overshadowed by all the fire that they've made. So there's lots of satire and irony going on here that kind of shows the state of somebody who's in that situation.
You could call it pride. I also like the term kind of ego here, that it takes a sense of a high egoness about you to kind of accept a leadership position, especially if you're not qualified to do it. So you see kind of the story of the trees who, you know, in this fable, in this example, might have the qualifications. You know, they provide wine, they provide, you know, food or whatever it is. They probably have that qualification, but they, you know, they feel like that they're best suited elsewhere. Then you have someone come along who's represented to be the bramble bush, and they said, yeah, I can lead, you know, go ahead, and if you're going to anoint me, then go for it. Yeah, that's kind of what I think of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really sad situation. And you know, we see this a lot. You don't have to be Abimelech. We see it in the church all the time. Pride, ego. Yeah, anytime you feel like you're really doing something, you know, for the Lord, instead of being a small piece of contributing to his kingdom, you know, you feel like you're sort of building your own empire. And I have to be careful of that. You know, I do a lot of ministry stuff, and it's something that we all have to be careful of. You know, are we all going to get to the point of Abimelech and like slaying your 70 brothers on the stone? No. I don't plan on beheading anyone personally. So there's that.
Good.
It's always a good thing, you know? But how many people have been spiritually beheaded by those who become abusive because they're ultimately a bramble? A lot. Yeah. You got to guard ourselves against that. Okay.
Yep, for sure.
Let's move on to the next thing, which is the spirit of evil. The spirit of evil. If you will, sir, please read verses 22 through 24.
I shall. 22 through 24. When Abimelech had ruled over Israel 3 years, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem. They treated Abimelech deceitfully, so that the crime against the 70 sons of Yerubbaal might come to justice, and their blood would be avenged on their brother Abimelech, who killed them, and on the citizens of Shechem, who had helped him kill his brothers. The citizens of Shechem rebelled against him. Oh, I was supposed to stop at 24.
You can read through 25. We need that in a minute anyway, so go ahead.
Okay, yep. The citizens of Shechem rebelled against him by putting men in ambush on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed everyone who passed by them on the road. So this was reported to Abimelech.
Okay, all right. So a few things here. So this is God starting to turn things around, right? So it's really clear now in the story that God's not happy, right? And it's not going the way that he intended. And so now God needs a way to sort of start to create strife and blow this thing up from the inside out. And there's going to be a few ways that this happens. So the first thing you notice is in verse 22, that God allowed them to stay in this condition. Look at that. When Abimelech had ruled over Israel 3 years. Now,
yep.
3 years is a long time under an oppressive king, right? I mean, there's some who would want to say that we've been 4 years under an oppressive king here in the United States, but I won't get into all of that. At this time, right? So 3 years is a long time to be under the rule of somebody who is oppressive, to be under the rule of a bramble king. And so there's consequences to our actions, right? I mean, here's a direct, it just looks like a passing statement, but what I see there is the consequences of sin. The consequence of anointing the bramble king is you got to live with the bramble king for 3 years.
Yep.
Okay? This is what you wanted? Cool. Like, here you go. You asked for it, you got it, right? But God always has a plan. God always wins. That's pretty much the story of the Bible. And so he starts the winning streak here with this evil spirit, okay? And so God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, an evil spirit. Okay, there was a time, Alex, here we go on the weird stuff. There was a time when I would have read that. And my immediate thought, and maybe yours too, you can tell me, my immediate thought would have been, oh, so he made them mad at each other. Is that how you would have read that, probably?
You know, what's funny is when I was reading through it, finally my mind has shifted. My initial inclination was, okay, God sent a literal spirit of evil or a spirit meant to do an evil bidding versus the contrary of just like a general like doom and gloom feeling over the people. But you're right. Originally, I would have read it, and that would have come into my mind first.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And don't get me wrong. I mean, you can find, especially on the ultra-conservative, you know, front, you can definitely find commentators who don't want to go there, you know, with the spiritual agency thing. But the reality from everything I've studied in the Bible is that God does use spiritual agency to accomplish his plans.
Spiritual and inhuman. It's such a big theme in the Bible where, I mean, yeah, there are certain instances where he steps in and does something specifically himself, but he allows change to happen at the hands of his heavenly hosts and at the hand of humans as well. So he's very big about other people using their agency to bring about change.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So again, my view here is that God sent this evil spirit to cause havoc and to cause the citizens of Shechem to treat Abimelech deceitfully, just like it says. And to actually, in verse 25, we see sort of, I called it in my outline, the sanctions of Shechem. They essentially based economic sanctions on him, right? What happened is that the citizens of Shechem went and hit an ambush so that when Abimelech's people traveled, they robbed them. Right. So Abimelech had to like stop traveling that way because he kept getting robbed and ambushed. Right. And stealing from him. So it's basically like modern day, like economic sanctions is something like what was going on there. Right. but right. So God sends this spirit of evil, and we don't have to belabor too long here because we're actually going to get into some of this divine being and a little bit of the divine council worldview stuff even next time when we talk. But for this, I thought it would just be appropriate to sort of look at another passage that may be familiar to an audience like ours, that helps illustrate the use of spiritual agency. And that's, from 1 Kings 22. Here's 1 Kings 22, 17 through 22. So the person speaking here is King Jehoshaphat relaying a story of the prophet Micaiah. This is what the prophet Micaiah, told him. Okay, so he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. let them return every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would prophesy no good concerning me, but evil? And he said, hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead? And one said on this manner, and another said on that manner. And there came forth a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith? And he said, I will go forth, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, thou shalt persuade him and prevail also. Go forth and do so. End quote. And so, well, this is like,
I know what you're going to say, Steve. Those are spirits, sons of God, heavenly hosts talking to God. But it's all just a metaphor for God. Have you seen the movie Inside?
No.
Pixar movie? It's just God's emotions.
Yeah,
talking to each other.
Yeah, there you go.
That's
it's just God's emotions.
That's what's happening there.
Yeah. It's not. it'd be weird if that was the case, right? This is probably one of the clearest examples we see in the Bible of like spiritual agency. Yeah. Like, if that context wasn't given and it had just said Yahweh was saying, I'm going to put a lying spirit in the mouth of Ahab. Mm-hmm. If it had just said that, we probably would still be talking about this whole, he just made him lie, right? He just put a spirit of lying in him, whatever that means, right?
Whatever that means.
But no, this is an actual divine council scene, a throne room scene, where the spirit stands up and says, among the heavenly host, I'll do it, right? Why not? I'll do it. Very similar in the book of Job to how Satan, or the Satan in this case, stands up and says, I'll go check out Job, no problem. Like, have you considered this guy? Like, I'll go do it, right? So, kind of volunteering, right? And so God allows him to do that. And so I see the same thing here. And again, this would be very consistent because in all of ancient literature, and the fact that this is a Canaanite text essentially makes this even more likely to have a character here like an evil spirit. By the way, how does God send a feeling? Have you ever sent a feeling? Think about that. God sent an evil spirit. Well, how did he send a random feeling of I don't like this guy? That doesn't even make sense, right? Yeah. Well, in ancient literature, of course, and I believe in the biblical worldview as well, but it was a very common thing, right, for the gods, to be able to send some sort of spirit to go do their bidding, right? This was a very common theme. So it would just be altogether weird for this to not mean that, okay? So again, just the point that we're making is this is not a random feeling. This is actual supernatural agency we see happening in this story. So I'm not looking, I'm really not trying to open up a peer under a rock and like find a woodlouse or whatever every single time with this divine counsel stuff. But it is really fascinating how often it actually shows up in the biblical text in ways that you just never even thought to look for it. But it's there, man. It's there. So.
And right, without the context of what happens there, you just kind of stumble over what we're reading here in Judges.
Yeah. Right? Isn't that wild? And so, I mean, I'm glad for that. I'm glad for that context so that we have something, like we have a framework for how to interpret passages like this. And what does it mean? Like again, what does it mean for God to send a deceitful spirit? Like, can God, I actually think I wrote this down for a topic for us to talk about. Like, is it okay for the God who doesn't lie, which is from the book of Titus? I think it's Titus 1, 3, maybe. I can't remember exactly, but, yeah, like God who can't lie, is it okay for him to use, deception? And I mean, he does, right? So we have to deal with that, right? He does. And obviously when the preservation of life is at stake or when God is, needs to bring about a certain outcome, it's clear that happens. I mean, Rahab was praised for her hiding the two spies and essentially lying to the people that came looking for them, right? So Corey Ten Boom, right? Was she disobeying God by like hiding people? No, that's a very natural thing to do, I think, to preserve life. So, So yeah, so I think it's totally appropriate for God to use a lying spirit if that's what's needed in the situation to bring about his purposes. And so in this case, they treated Abimelech deceitfully, and they put the economic sanctions on him. And this is just the beginning of the vice grip being sort of squeezed down on Abimelech. And next time we're together, we're going to look at this character who seemingly comes out of nowhere and submits his, bid to rule the citizens of Shechem and the city of Shechem. And this guy's name is Gaal. So next time we'll dive into the sedition of Gaal, and the story just really, really starts to get crunk when we go there.
Get crunk, yes. Everyday lingo there.
Totally. It makes sense.
I'm excited. And I love, it's just a great story. The storytelling of it, it's just going to lead to a really excellent conclusion.
Oh, the conclusion is fire. Don't read ahead. The conclusion is so
good. You know what's
funny?
I know I've read this story before, because as we're going through, I remember reading about it like through some college classes. And I just haven't read the rest of it because I just want to read it as we're going through it.
Advised. The story has a very dramatic ending. It's very epic. And so I don't want you to miss it. So well, that's it for this time, Alex.
Yeah, this was great. I'm so glad that you decided to cover this 100%. It was a really good discussion. And will part three be the last of it, finishing up with it?
Yeah, unless I get way too long-winded. It should be. And, I'll just say, too, that if you like the series, let us know. You know, in the YouTube comments, go to YouTube and leave a comment below this video. And let us know, because we're thinking about doing some other series. The thing about the series thing is, of course, it helps to get content, right? It helps for episodes. But, like, this is the perfect format to go long form, right? I mean, to just really dive deep into something. This is not like a sermon where we're like, you know, we got butts in seats and we're tied to, you know, 20 or 30 minutes before everybody's trying to go out and get some, you know, some of God's chicken, which they can't do on Sunday. I guess that would be a Wednesday thing. Anyway.
Yes.
KFC on Sunday, right?
Unless you're a Seventh-day Adventist.
That's true. In which case, you're probably not listening to this podcast. If you are, welcome. We really disagree. But anyway, maybe we'll talk about that sometime. But yeah, let us know if you like the series and like diving deep into things, because I know we enjoy it. And we got some more series, I think, planned. I think one that we'd like to do something with pretty soon, probably, is Exodus-related stuff. Lots of fun Exodus stuff that we can talk
about.
That's
going to be fun.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And again, Steve and I, like, we are up for everything. We like doing these long-form ones. I know Steve's kind of taking control of this one a little bit, but we like getting into a chapter or two, and we could spend 4 or 5 hour-long episodes on it just so we could, like, really flush it out, dig into it, and really understand it more. But then we also like quick one-offs, or, you know, doing some type of fun thing. So, yeah, we're definitely up for a variety.
Totally. Yeah, totally. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And so, yeah, let us know if you have specific questions or specific ideas as well in the comments. And most of all, like it, share it, subscribe if you're not a subscriber yet. And please tell somebody else about it. Tell people at your church. Share it in Facebook groups. You have our permission to do that. Share it in Facebook 100%. Groups. Let other people know about this content. And we'd like to get it in as many hands as possible and see what the Lord can do with it. So,
sounds good, Steve. Looking forward to next time, my friend.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. A pleasure as always.